Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Can you actually make a living sustainably harvesting local salmon? How hard is it? Is it as freezing a venture as it sounds? Any tricks of the trade? Not. I don't suspect that many of you are going to go out and want to, you know, put the hook into the old salmon. But you know, fun, kind of fun to hear. Any ways to be kinder to the fish? It must not be very fun to have the hook in the mouth and then be. I see them flapping on the boat and all that. Is wild salmon really healthier than farmed salmon? Is it more environmentally friendly? Does the guest I've got here have any fish stories? With me in the studio is a guy who makes a living catching fish, selling them at farmers markets. His business is called Hudson Fish Company. He's from Germany, or at least he grew up in Germany. He's got a little German accent, but he's actually born here. He left there. He said he wasn't crazy about Germany and Germans. He said, Germany's a lovely country, but then there were the Germans. We won't go there. But in any case, his business is called Hudson Fish Company. Subtitle, I like this. California wild-caught king salmon and other creatures from the deep, directly from fishermen to you. Mike Hudson, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
How are you doing, Marty? Good to be here.
It's my pleasure to have you. So can you actually make a living sustainably harvesting local salmon?
Well, Marty, yes, you can. You know, it's getting a little harder every year, it seems like, and our industry has enough problems to make a grown man cry, and I mean that literally.
Wow. Really?
I've been there myself, and I've seen a lot of grown men break out into tears
like
at
our
Pacific Fishery Management Council meetings a few years ago when we were told we weren't allowed to fish anymore.
Why
for
not?
1 year, for 2 years, for 3 years, due to no fault of our own, but, you know, it's like when we suck too much water out of our rivers, these fish cannot survive.
So this is an environmentalists?
It's an environmental issue, and it's really due to the utter corruption of our political system. That's really it, you know. But then again, as a fisherman, you got to be an eternal optimist.
Wow.
And you suck it up and you go back to work. And so, yes, you can make a living. And I've been doing it for over 20 years now. And no point stopping now.
What's an example of the corruption that you're talking about?
Well, you know, we make our living off a natural resource. And these salmon are a natural resource, right? And we don't own them. You own them. And all the people of California own these salmon, and the people of the United States own these salmon. And then you go and you give me a permit to go catch them. You say, hey, Mike, we can't all go out fishing ourselves, so here's a job for you. You go and you catch them in a certain way, right? You use barbless hooks. You only are allowed to catch them with hook and lines, barbless hooks. And then we give you areas where you are allowed to fish, where you're not allowed to fish, and certain times when you're allowed to fish there, so that we make sure that the resource stays sustainable. And that part of the job works really, really well. And it's a fantastic business as far as that goes. But then we see a lot of our most powerful senators so deep in the pockets of the billion-dollar agricultural corporations that also want that same water that our salmon need. Then we're starting to get problems, right? We're seeing this with Dianne Feinstein. We've seen it with our governor and all the appointed officers in all these agencies that are supposed to protect our fish, right? We trust in our government to protect that resource for us so that we have it again next year and the year after and so forth, right? So there's too much money in the political system right now.
Yeah, I didn't want to go on the. I wanted to focus because this show focuses on careers. I wanted to focus on what it's like to be in the career. But you know, I remember, and as I looked through your website, you were interviewed for a media story in which President Obama had said in his State of the Union address that the Interior Department is in charge of salmon while they're in the fresh water, but the Commerce Department then handles the salmon when they're in salt water, and it gets even more complicated once the fish gets smoked. You said that, quote, government has long made life difficult for small business fishermen like you. So in addition to the corruption and the big money, how else does government interagency problems or whatever, how does that affect your life as a fisherman?
How much time do we got, Marty?
Wow.
I could talk for days about this, right?
Pick one thing.
The one thing that's really on the horizon right now, which is going to totally kill us, is individual fishing quotas, where we take all these fish that we own, I mean, that the people own, and we take these fish out of the ownership of the people and put them into ownership of the fishermen. And then we all get quotas, right? Mike can go catch a ton, and Bob can go catch a ton, and so forth, right? And then all of a sudden, we own this resource as fishermen, but you know, as soon as we own it, we can also lose it. And we've seen that worldwide, that whenever that kind of management scheme goes into effect, that the fishermen lose the access to these fish, that the people lose access to this fish. We've seen it on the East Coast right now, where all the clam fishery went into individual fishing quotas. Corporations ended up buying up all the quota shares, and the corporations got sold, and now a British corporation owns pretty much all the clams on the entire East Coast. So those kind of things are really weighing us down heavily.
So it's kind of like the family farm. Are you saying that really for a young person who would love to spend his life on the sea, whether it be organic tomatoes or it be sustainably harvested salmon or whatever, would you encourage or discourage your son to become a fisherman? Or daughter, of course, to become a fisher. We must be careful.
Yeah, actually, there are some women fishermen in our fleet, and they are tough. I have a hard time keeping up with them.
Okay.
Would I encourage my son to become a fisherman? You know, it's like I would encourage anybody to do whatever it is that they love to do best in life.
Even if you starve?
If you starve, you know, it's like it doesn't matter. You know, if you do something that you really like in life, you end up not working a day.
I got to tell you, you know what? That's the cliches that I hear again and again and again. But as a career counselor, I think that is the biggest crock of BS. That is, it's not your fault because it's said all the time. But I have seen countless people, you talked about tears in their eyes, who spend their lives trying to be actors or radio talk show hosts, and they're in Section 8 housing, they have no health care, they're depressed, they're worrying about whether they're going to... They cut their medication in half because they can't afford to have it go all day. So, you know, I found that the happiest people in the world are really the people who I can't do what they hate. I'm not saying work in a clanging carcinogenic, you know, smelting factory, but I am saying that having a decent job with a reasonable boss and be reasonably productive and reasonably ethical, reasonable job security and reasonable benefits, and then you fish on the side or you act on the side or you're a comedian on the side, normally for the vast majority of people is a formula for a life well led. You want to push back on that?
For most people, that might be true, right? But it's for most people, it's also true that they can't run a business of their own, right?
True.
And they're better off working for somebody else. And I've seen that in our industry, as I've seen in other industries. You know, we have deckhands that fish for a really good fisherman for years on end, and then they decide to buy their own boat. They say, you know, it's like I'm only getting a certain percentage of the catch. If I owned my own boat, I would get it all. And, you know, it's like after a while they fail. From that standpoint on, yeah, you're right. But on the other hand, you know, it's like I put in 18-hour days.
Wow.
Without blinking an eye.
Jeez.
And, you know,
18-hour days?
Yeah, well, you know, it's like 3 o'clock in the morning, cup of coffee, check the oil, check the coolant, start up the engine, pull up the anchor, run out to the fishing grounds for 3 hours, 4 hours, whatever it takes to get there. Then you fish all day until it's dark, and then after it's dark, you turn back towards the nearest anchorage, and before you know it, like 18 hours have passed, 18 hours, 20 hours, something like that. And it's physical work, it's a lot of labor, you know, at times it's boring, at times it's super exciting, you know, especially when the wind picks up to like 35 or something like that. But at the end of the day, I really don't feel like I put in like an 8-hour day working for somebody else and dealing with their little problems, you know.
You talked about deckhands. Do you have, who's on the boat with you?
Yeah, sitting right in front of you, the entire crew of the boat.
I had a feeling, just yourself, yeah. Was that by choice? Do you kind of an introverted guy who likes to be by himself, or is it because you're needing to save the money and not hire somebody? Or why don't you have deckhands?
I do like my solitude. I really do. That's one part of the choice. The other thing is, since we're doing farmers markets, I'm not one of the bigger producers in the fleet anymore. So I only go out and catch what my wife really needs for the farmers market, and for a lot for most of the time that wouldn't be enough to actually feed a deckhand, you know, to give him enough money to make a living off.
Right. You said the fleet. Now, you run your own. You have one boat. It's your boat. When you're talking about the fleet, do you mean all the people who have licenses in the Bay Area to go out and fish?
All the people in California, yes. Yeah. From Morro Bay all the way up to Crescent City.
How many people do you think actually full-time make their living as a small fisherman who, or fisherwoman, who makes their living selling fish, whether it be to restaurants or to farmers markets or whatever? Any idea?
Honestly, I have no idea. I can tell you about our salmon fleet, which, used to be about 5,000 boats back in the 80s in California, and now we're down to about 1,000. Mm-hmm. And out of the 1,000 permits that we have out there, there's 100, 150 full-time commercial fishermen in California. But then also some of the guys from Oregon have California permits. Some of the California guys have Oregon permits. And when we have good seasons, boats will come down from Oregon, from Washington, from Alaska to fish in California.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. We're talking about what it's really like to be a fisherman. We've talked about we kind of do the semi-regular segment here on Work with Marty Nemco, where we, I've talked with everybody from psychiatrists to prostitutes, and I had been remiss this was after 25 years, I'm kind of thinking, what haven't I discussed yet? And I was just curious about fish and stuff. What do you, we live in vegan land here in the Bay Area where, it used to be everybody was a meat eater and then they went and they just ate fish and then they don't eat farm-raised fish anymore. Now it's got to be wild, sustainably harvested local fish. What do you say to the large and growing vegan community, especially listening to a station like this?
I tell you, a couple of years ago, I went to the neighborhood sushi bar down the street and I sat next to a lady who I've never met before, and she was ordering the farmed salmon. And because all the sushi, the salmon at the sushi bar is always the farmed salmon, right? And she says, "Man, the salmon is great. You should really try it." And I said, "No, sorry, this is against my religion." Right. She says, "What do you mean by that?" I said, "Yeah, so I'm a commercial fisherman. I catch wild caught salmon, and wherever in the world these salmon are farmed, the wild salmon go extinct." And turns out, she liked sushi and she liked her farmed salmon, but she did not like commercial fishermen.
Why?
Yeah, so she didn't speak another word to me for
because you were harvesting fish.
Yeah. So, what? If you want to be a vegan and vegetarian, that's great. I have no problems with that. And I do eat vegetarian a lot of the times too when I don't eat salmon. To each his own, and I think there's a lot of good things about being a vegan and a vegetarian, rather than eating all the beef and the poultry and the pork and all the stuff that, actually takes more water.
Right. Question. It's hard to tell what's science and what's not, but certainly the people who are, say, in the anti-GMO crowd, they're ones who say that the farmed fish are eating horrible, toxic crap, and it's much more dangerous for you, and it's not just the orange color, but it's really toxic. To the best you can be fair, because you live in this world, what is the fairest statement you can make about the health benefits of wild versus farmed?
Well, these wild king salmon that we catch, they are nice and fatty, and they've been eating just what Mother Nature provided them for their entire lives, right? They're out there eating krill, anchovies, sardines, herring, squid, and all just real natural foods, and I don't think you can beat it. They have a lot of omega-3 fatty acids in there that are healthy for you, and they're good for the environment.
Okay, now I got just a personal question. I kind of bought the notion and didn't figure it matters much. I shop at Trader Joe's all the time, and Trader Joe's makes a point of calling it wild-caught salmon or whatever. How much can I trust the label? If I go into Trader Joe's and it says wild-caught salmon, fresh frozen, flash frozen, is there anything wrong with this? Is that good?
I think there's a lot of people keeping an eye out, especially on big retailers like that, which one you're talking about. So I think you can probably trust them. You know, it's like if you go to little restaurants, you know, and they put wild salmon on their menu, you will get a lot of funny business.
Got it. Very good. That makes a lot of sense to me. It makes sense. How, you know, I'm not a fisherman at all, and so my frame of reference is like Old Man and the Sea and Moby Dick and horrible gale winds and the captain saying, "We're gonna go anyway, I don't care, we're gonna go to the..." How cold, how hard really is it here in the Bay Area? I mean, I still think, you know, when I'm out in San Francisco, I'm just walking on Fisherman's Wharf, I'm freezing my butt off. What's it really like out there where you're fishing?
Well, first of all, you dress for the occasion, right? My wife, she gives me a couple of guidelines every time I go out. She says, don't go to the Flemish Cap, right?
And what does that mean?
Oh, that's from The Perfect Storm. You haven't seen the movie, read the book?
I didn't.
Okay,
no.
Well, the Andrea Gale goes out to the Flemish Cap to catch these swordfish, which is like way, way out there somewhere, thousands of miles away from their home port, and they end up in this perfect storm and everybody dies. It is always foggy when we're fishing, and it's always windy. Mm. It's cold. It is that way.
What do you wear? Are you wearing like a wetsuit kind of thing, or what do you wear?
Well, pair of nice warm socks, sweatpants, sweatshirt, and then rubber gear over that, and you get out on the back deck, and that's okay. And sometimes actually the sun comes out, and then you start peeling off your layers, and you're out there in a t-shirt and shorts, and then the next day it's windy and foggy again.
Now you always have this, you know, again, this is from the movies, that there's a, you know, it, because it gets cold out there or whatever, there's a lot of drinking that goes on. I mean, do people get pretty wasted when they're out there? You say it can get boring a lot of the time?
No. We're out there to work, right? Mm. And I learned that from one of my first captains that I ever worked for. You know, it's like I came onto his boat and had a six-pack of beer on me, and he says, you know what? All the accidents that ever happen out there, you know, somebody runs their boat onto the rocks or anything that goes ever wrong on the boat is all attributed to alcohol and drugs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's like, you want to stay in this business, you leave the booze at home. Mm. And that's what I do. You know, I used to never have any alcohol on the boat. Go out on a 3-5 day trip, come back home and go to the harbor bar and have a couple of cocktails there with the boys. That ends up a little expensive because the prices for cocktails at the Harbor Bar are like $8 or so.
Right.
So now I bring a bottle of whiskey along, and whenever I come back to port and somebody else caught more fish than I invite him over and we drink some whiskey, and then I find out where he was fishing and how he got all these fish, you know.
I guess this is a good time to turn to fish stories then. So let's, you know, you say sometimes it's boring and sometimes it gets exciting. Mm. What's your most exciting catch or the most exciting experience? You said the winds get to 35 miles an hour, but tell me the most exciting experience you've had as a commercial fisherman.
Well, I'll tell you my favorite salmon fishing story.
Perfect.
It was a trip towards the end of the season. We were fishing out in the Bolinas area on the Marin Coast, and I was out there for 5 days. I caught nothing.
5 days, nothing?
Nothing, right.
Wow.
And on the fifth day, I said, okay, I'm going to give it 15 more minutes, and I'm going to pull the plug on it. I'm going home.
Whoa.
And all of a sudden, I went over a little spot, and I caught a 50-pound salmon. That's after it's gutted and gilled. It's a monster. I've never seen a fish that big.
Interesting.
I turned the boat around, went over the same spot, and I caught another one of that size.
Huh.
And then I just kept going back and forth for the next 2 hours, and I caught another 20 fish. They were all over 20 pounds.
Wow.
So it's like the fifth day just really made the entire trip. But then what made it so fantastic, because it's miserable, you know, it's like you're out there for 5 days and your diesel engine just goes chuckity, 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 and you catch nothing.
Burning gas. Yeah.
And so these 50-pound fish, when we were filleting them out for the farmer's market, I told my wife, I want you to cut me a couple of nice big fat steak out of this 50-pound fish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unheard of. You cannot cut steaks out of a 50-pound fish because they are about a foot and a half in diameter, and they weigh about 5-6 pounds. And so she She said a couple of words about the state of my mental health. but she caught me these steaks, and we went to the farmer's market, and I didn't even put them on display. She says, what are you going to do with these steaks? I said, you know what? I'm going to find the right person for them. And towards the end of the market, there was this big guy, big Samoan guy. He was like 6 foot something, 400 pounds, all dressed in traditional Samoan garbs. Huh. And he had his little girlfriend with him. She's about, 5 foot, if that much, and weighs 90 pounds. Right. And I called him over because he was just walking by. He wasn't even interested in buying fish or anything. I said, I want to show you something. And I reached, what do you want? Yeah. And I reached into the cooler and I pulled out this big Flintstone-sized salmon steak. And I said, man, this would look so good on your grill. And that instant, a little sliver of drool came out of the side of his mouth. And he looks at his girlfriend and he says, can I? And she jabs him in the side with her elbow and says, you go, you big lug. And I've never, ever, before or after, I've never, ever seen a man that was so happy in my entire life. And you know what? All the misery that you go through sometimes with all the fog and the wind and the cold and the boredom of not catching anything, that was all made up in that moment because it was worth it.
You know, I got to tell you, what strikes me even in that whole story is the most exciting day was when you had, it sounded like maybe, a couple of hundred pounds of net fish. And that can only sell for $20 a pound or whatever, or 15. What are you selling?
Back then, I think we were selling it for around $10 a pound.
So $10 a pound. So you've got, maybe you got a few hundred pounds, say 300 pounds of fish. That's $3,000 after 5 days burning all that diesel fuel. It's got to be a hell of a tough time to make. And nobody's paying your health care insurance and nobody's paying you nothing. You've got to be, it's a tough living, isn't it? And that was your best day.
Well, it's not the best day of fishing, right? So, on my best day of fishing, I go out there and I catch 100 fish or 130 fish.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Something like that. But that was kind of my favorite day. And not every day is like that. It's like, you never know when you're going to catch these fish. You might catch nothing for the entire month, and then there's this one day when you catch your 100 fish, and then you go turn right back around and you catch another 100, and that makes your entire month. So you never know when it's going to happen. Wow. The average catch that you do come home with varies from year to year. Sometimes it's on average 10 fish a day. Sometimes it's on average 20 fish a day. In my best year, my very best average, and everybody was scared of me that year. It was like 60 fish a day every day I went out, So you never know, but you just got to love the business and you got to love being out there on the ocean and you got to love your boat, you got to love yourself, you got to love these fish.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Mike Hudson. He has been a commercial fisherman for 20-plus years. 20-plus, is that right?
Yes,
Yeah, and his business is called Hudson Fish Company, California Wild-Caught King. I love this on his website. California Wild-Caught King Salmon and Other Creatures from the Deep, directly from the fisherman to you. You're at farmers markets. Which farmer? Let's give you a little plug here before the end. What farmers markets do we find your stuff?
Well, first of all, go to our website at hudsonfish.com, and the schedule of our farmers markets is on the website.
Perfect.
But we do the Berkeley farmers markets on Thursday and Saturday. We do the El Cerrito market on Saturday and the Kensington farmers market on Sunday.
Perfect. So now I want to feel the experience of catching a fish. So you're sitting there, you were bored for 3 hours, 6 hours, 4 days, who knows? And walk me through, paint a vivid picture of what happens when things start to change and there is a fish on the line.
Okay, you've been to Fisherman's Wharf and you've seen the commercial boats there. They have these big sticks that go 40 feet up in the air. These are outrigger poles. When we go out to sea, we let them out to about a 45-degree angle and all the gear, all the hooks come down from these lines. So I troll with usually about 36 hooks behind the boat on four wires, and all these hooks are on monofilament fishing line that are about You know, the lines are about 20 feet long with a hook on the end. And when the fish start biting, you have springs on the tips of your poles, and the springs, they start twitching just a little bit, you know. It's like you really got to watch them all day long.
Wow.
And you got to run your gear a lot of times, because sometimes you just don't see when they're biting. But then when you're getting into the bite, you're navigating the boat at the same time as you're catching fish, at the same time as you're cleaning fish and icing them up and all of that. So you set the autopilot on a certain course, and you go on the back deck, and you run your hydraulics, and you hand line all the fish in. You put them on the deck, you know, 5 fish, 10 fish, 20 fish. Put all your gear back in the water. You jump out of the work pit and the back deck, run back into the wheelhouse. You turn the boat around to go right back where you came from. You get back on the back deck, and you start cleaning all these fish. You cut out the guts and the gills and bleed them, you know, wash them, make them, you know, really nice and beautiful and presentable. And all of that has to be done really fast, because you don't want to let them lay out on the deck for too long. We want to come in with the best product that you can. So then they go into the refrigerated tank. Then you turn the boat back around, go back in the other direction, and you start pulling your gear and putting more fish on the deck, and then you turn her around and do it all over again, all the while watching out for other boats that might be coming out of the fog. You know, pretty much zero visibility fog. You keep watching the radar, you watch your GPS and all of these kind of things all day long until you're done.
How many months a year do you do this?
5.5 months out of the year. Our season usually starts 1st of May, and it goes till October 15th.
And that's a law, that's a salmon season, is that correct?
Yes. And it's all set to protect the weaker stocks of salmon that are out there in the water. We catch king salmon only. There's 5 different species of salmon in our waters, right? And we're only trying to target the king salmon that comes from the Sacramento River. And out of these fish, we're only trying to target the fish that are from the fall run of the Sacramento River.
Why?
Because since we put all these dams up on our rivers, it turns out that the fall run salmon has become the strongest run of salmon around. And the winter run and the spring run, they're kind of really ailing. They're having a hard time getting by. So under all circumstances, we must try to avoid catching the winter and the spring run fish until the day when we actually, you know, get enough oomph to put some water back in the rivers during the times that these fish need it, so we get those numbers back up.
Yeah, and so during the other 6.5 months of the year, do you hang out? Or as your website says, other creatures from the deep? What do you do?
Well, towards the late summer, I usually re-rig and go on a couple of albacore trips, because they're pretty tasty fish too. And then after all is said and done, and we put the boat away for the winter, I help out some of my friends go catch Dungeness crabs in the wintertime, especially towards the beginning of the season, when they're working in new deckhands and the fishing is hot and heavy. So I'll do that. And, I've been an electrical contractor before I started this, and I can do a whole lot of things, because when I'm, you know, running my boat, I got to be my own carpenter, my own electrician, my own plumber, hydraulics expert, refrigeration guy. Wow. I got to be my own boat ride. I got to do all these things just to keep the boat up. And we beat the hell out of these boats during the season, right? So everything breaks and everything needs a lot of maintenance. So I spend a lot of time in the winter month on boat maintenance, and then I help some of my friends out with some of their projects.
You know, I got to end by praising you. I don't usually do this with my guests, but anybody who's been a regular listener to the show knows that I have the deepest respect for people who don't have any prestige in their job and are not getting rich, but working their butt off to do something honorable. And I can't think in my 25 years of hosting this show of talking to somebody who is more exemplary of that than you. So, Mike Hudson, I tip my non-sailor's cap to you, sir. I really appreciate you being here on Work with Marty Nemco.
appreciate it, Marty. Thank you.
Yeah. And again, his website where you can find out which farmer's markets he's at is hudsonfish.com. And he's at Berkeley, if I remember correctly, Berkeley on Thursdays and Saturdays, El Cerrito and Kensington. And so there you go. You take care and you be well. You take care of yourself, huh?
I will. I'll do my best. I'll do my best, Marty. Thanks.
All right. You be well. Okay, my dear listeners, now we turn to you. As usual in the second half of the show, my mission in life, not just mission on the radio, but really my mission in life is to help you. This is what I'm put on this earth to do. So if you've got a career problem, any sort, I don't care your age, I don't care whether you are a clerk, you're a CEO or a fisherman. If you've got, and you can stick around for a few minutes. So if you've got a question for Mike, you can even call in with that. If you want me to help you, that's great. You have a question or a comment for Mike Hudson, my hero here for today. It's quite heroic when you really think about what he's doing. You know,
you always wanted to ask a fisherman, but we're always afraid.
Afraid to ask.
Yes.
That's right. Well, he won't stick a hook into you, I promise. Anyway, for all those reasons, 3-minute work over or speak to Mike Hudson. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And, you know, in recent weeks, what I've been doing, waiting for the calls to come in or whatever, I've been sharing under-the-radar careers. But I'm also, I've become very addicted to Twitter, and every time I get a half decent idea, I'm going to forget it. So I go to Twitter and I just put it there. It's like this archive of my best ideas. So I'm going to share some of those. But of course, no sooner did I give out the phone number than the lines are going wild here. So we're going to go right to the phones in a moment. So let's see. Can we go to the phones? She's busy, so I'm going to go and offer a tip. So I guess we do have a call in the line. We have a call in the line? Great. Thank you very much. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's your question either for Mike Hudson or myself?
Marty, it's for you. My name is Jeff. I'm a longtime listener, an incredible fan.
Thank you.
I'm embarking on a second career. I'm 73 years old. Mm-hmm. I'm a retired dentist. Mm-hmm. I did some coursework, prepared and studied and passed the state exam to be a lead-based paint inspector. Mm-hmm. Any ideas on how I might go forward?
Okay. So, obviously, that was not a random choice. Sometimes, usually, when people retire as a dentist, they either go and they train other dentists or they volunteer or whatever. But you went and you became a lead-based paint expert. You're credentialed. Have you tried the obvious? I mean, have you gone to Cal OSHA, Cal EPA, local? I know that there's tremendous political pressure in places like Oakland to get lead paints out of inner city neighborhoods, where we show the commercials with the kid eating the paint and getting brain damage as a result. Have you made the full, if you will, the 32-tooth cleaning of that marketplace to find that kind of job?
Good question. I'm in the process of doing that, but I'm more of a person that wants to work for myself.
Uh-huh.
And the reason I chose this as a second, let's just say, application, mm-hmm. is it offers the opportunity for me to work when I want to work. And when you do an inspection in a home, you can get $400 to $500. It's good money. It sure beats working at McDonald's.
Well, it strikes me that individual homeowners are unlikely to pay to $400 to $500, and it's hard enough. It'll be too hard to market to get those individual people. There just aren't enough people worried about it, and frankly, the people with all the lead-based paints who are worried about it tend to be low-income people. So it would seem to me that you'd be trying to pitch yourself as that inspector to the entities, government or nonprofit, that do that. Have you done sufficient research to identify the entities that say, we're taking West Oakland and we're going to go and clean up that damn lead paint out of there? Have you found the agencies or nonprofits that are in that biz?
Yeah. Well, the way to do it is because of HUD's legislation, what you need to do is work with contractors or building materials people. They have to comply.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's going to be any disturbance, the key language is disturb paint. If there's going to be any disturbance on houses, structures 1978 or earlier, the RRPs, the contractors, and the building materials people They're the people that have to comply, not the homeowner.
But they may have to comply.
Or say the home occupier.
I'm just having this gut feeling. I could be wrong. Let's say I'm this contractor, and I'm going to go, and I got this house in West Oakland, and it's an old house, and I'm going to gut it, I'm going to refor it, I'm going to, you know, redo it or whatever. And I know I've got to use good paint, and maybe there's this crappy lead paint there. But I'm going to figure out a way without having to pay somebody $500 to say that's lead paint. I'll take a chip of the paint. I'll take it to Kelly Moore, and they'll tell me whether it's got lead in it or something. I'm worried that it won't. There isn't enough business. Am I being too pessimistic?
You're one heck of a terrific guy. It's more complicated. You have to do paint chip analysis. You can't go to the paint store. You have to go to a professional laboratory. And if you did go that route, you'd have to take chips of paint off of each of the walls in the house that may be disturbed. The cost would be prohibitive.
Okay.
So there's portable XRF analyzers based on radioactive elements that can get all that information for you, and where you're not disturbing the environment. And those devices cost $15,000 to $20,000. Contractors do not do that work themselves.
Okay. And are there in this space, are there particular contractors? You know, very often, especially in the inner city, the government gives preference to minority contractors. Are there some major contractors that tend to get the lion's share of that rehab work that I'm talking about? I'm picturing West Oakland per se, but there's many others, obviously. Have you identified those contractors that get the lion's share of that work?
No, I haven't. That's a very good suggestion. How would you do that?
Okay, what I probably would do is I would contact the California Department of HUD. I imagine HUD does a lot of redevelopment work. And I would visit their website and see, or I might, you know, I'm always the guy, I'm lazy, I start with Google. So I'd probably just start and look at general contractors, HUD, FHA, Oakland, or wherever you live, because you don't want to have to trek in the terrible traffic that is getting worse and worse. You find... I'm sorry, where do you live?
No, I live in San Leandro.
Okay, right. So, you know, Oakland is the, you know, is the biggest city around. It's got a lot of that stuff, I'm guessing. So I'd Google Oakland General Contractor FHA redevelopment. Redevelopment's a good word because that's a public sector word. And see if I could find the names of... once I found one contractor, they know their competitors. So once I talk to one and they say, nah, sorry, I don't need you, you say, oh, by the way, but do you know who are the other guys, women or whatever, firms that get a lot of this kind of work, and you'll probably get the half a dozen of them. Or one other thought, there is a contractors association. You go to one meeting and there's going to be 20 people who are very active and involved in that. You ask them, hey, who gets a lot of that work that in inner city redevelopment? And that will probably get you enough people, and that's how you get your business. What do you think?
I think that's a great idea. You're just one heck of a guy for a lot of us out here. Thank you so much.
You're too kind, Jeff. Thanks for listening. Take care.
You bet. Bye.
All our lines are lighted up. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. Your turn on the air. You want to talk to me? You want to talk to Mike Hudson? Hi, it's you.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi there. My question is for Mike Hudson, specifically about the radiation from Fukushima and its impact on the local catch here. Second question, which I'll take off the air, is are there any testing bodies that are actually testing the fish that are being caught to see if there's traces of radiation from Fukushima?
Okay, we have absolutely zero concern in our salmon fishery about Fukushima radiation. I mean, zero. A lot of tests have been done. There's a lot of universities out there. There's a lot of testing by the government that happens to see if our sea kelp, which is like the first organism that would contract any radiation from Fukushima, has any traces of it, and there are none. We have had fishermen up in Washington I forget the guy's name right now, but he's a very active guy up there. Loki Fish Market in Washington. He had his own fish tested at his own expense by the universities, and it came up at you know, zero. And the way these currents go, the ocean currents go, you would see it in Seattle, Washington, way before you would ever see it down here in California.
You know, you could say he's a fisherman, he's trying to, you know, sell his fish, but I have been, I once got an email from this guy who's kind of well-known conspiracy guy. He's got all kinds of conspiracies. And he was talking about a plume coming across, you know, from Japan and whatever. But then, you know, because I do eat salmon, I also just care about my health. I went and did some more research, and there really, Mike is 1,000% right. There is unanimity that there is no increase in any significant way at all. So feel free to eat your salmon, especially your wild salmon. And I'll thank you for the call. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Mike Hudson. What's your question or comment for him or me? Hi, it's
my
you.
Turn?
Yeah.
Hi. I would love your guest to tell us how he got into commercial fishing in the first place.
Good question, Mike.
Oh yeah. That I've always been a fisherman. From when I was a kid, I was a sport fisherman. Growing up in Germany, I was actually a state champion.
Really?
Yes. You know, you probably had a baseball coach or a basketball coach or football coach, something like that. When I was in school, I had a fishing coach.
Really?
I always loved fishing. I loved that big mystery that happens down there underneath the surface of the sea where you just cannot see it. You know, it's all imagination. Mm-hmm. My wife and I, we were always sport fishing. We had a little 16-foot boat, and then we got a little 20-foot boat, and then after a while my wife looked at me and says, you know, with all that money that we're spending, it's great that we have all this fresh fish, all the crabs and the salmon and the whatever we're catching, the rockfish and all of that, but you know, it's like the cost of the new outboard motor and the cost of the fishing poles and all of that, we could actually buy that fish a lot cheaper than we're actually catching it for. So I looked at her and says, that was the stupidest thing I ever said in my life. I said, baby, why don't we just go get ourselves a commercial fishing boat? And that's how this whole career started. We weren't going to be, you know, serious about this business. We just wanted to, you know, piddle around in it, and then we just got totally sucked into it.
And you, if you were right now, if you were 18 years old, year 2014, would you do it again?
Of course.
There you go. Dear caller, you know, maybe you have a new career as a radio interviewer or something. That was a great question. I appreciate it.
I have a follow-up. How will he ever retire?
Good question. Will you ever? You know, I'm a guy who will never retire. I want to die in front of a client, or I want to die in front of my computer. Will you do this till you drop dead, or you want to retire?
No. Before I drop dead, I think I still want to become a world-famous blues musician.
Oh, really? Do you bring your axe, whatever your instrument is, on the boat?
No, it's not a good environment for a guitar or even the harmonicas. They get rusty, you know. I play some music in the off season. I got a little band, and we're having a lot of fun playing music. But how am I ever going to retire? I don't know. I'm going to get too old one day to actually go out there and do this. It's a very physical job. Yeah. And at 50 now, I feel it a lot more than I felt it when I was 35. So I bet you by the time I get 70, I doubt I'll still be in this business.
Carl, you're 2 for 2. You got one more?
No, but thank you so much. It was a fantastic interview.
And you were a fantastic caller. Thanks so much.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. Fisherman Mike Hudson, commercial fisherman. We were talking about what's it really like to be a fisherman. So you can either ask me for a 3-minute workover, you know, career makeover. I can't decide which is a better term. Or you can ask Mike Hudson, our great fisherman and hero. As I said earlier, I just love guys and women who work really hard, really ethically to produce something that's good for humanity and don't get any credit for it. He's a hero in my mind. Let's go back to the phones. Your turn on the air. What's your question or comment?
Oh, I've got two questions.
Okay.
First of all, how, if at all, is the drought affecting his work and his business? Huh. The second question is, I, too, shop at Trader Joe's a great deal, and I wonder who is watching the monitoring of the wild fish label on the salmon.
We addressed the second question earlier. He Mike is convinced that even though he's the guy who sells at farmers markets, that there really is a lot of watchdogs for the large vendors. But
yeah,
the drought, how does the drought affect...
Name one vendor. Name one watchdog.
Okay, we're not going to go there. That's just more... he doesn't have the names of the watchdog organizations. What's your answer to his good question? About, and I'll thank you for the call. You can hear the answer off the air. How is the drought, if at all, affecting? You wouldn't think the drought would affect the water.
Well, of course, the drought affects the water, right? And the salmon.
I think there's still
these salmon
water.
need the water in our rivers in order to make the offspring. They're an anadromous fish, right? So the adults have to come back up the river to lay their eggs to spawn, and then they die, and then the baby fish have to find their way down the river back to the ocean, and that is a very tough proposition for these baby fish, because we have all these giant pumps in the delta that suck the water in the wrong direction, and the fish only know one way to get to the ocean, and that's to follow the currents. At this point, it's not affecting us at all, because the fish that we're catching this year and possibly even next year have been in the ocean since before the drought started. In a couple of years from now, all bets are off, really. But with all the pressure that we've been putting on our agencies lately, the national and the state hatcheries have done a fantastic job trucking and barging these baby fish down the river to the San Francisco Bay, so they circumvent all that deadly gauntlet of the delta over there. So we'll see what happens in about 3 years. Either we'll have a real kick-ass season in 3 years, or we're going to be out of work again.
Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. Mike Hudson, what's your question or comment for either of us? Hi, it's you.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Perfectly.
Oh, great. I have a request for a three-minute career workover.
Sure.
But I also appreciate Mr. Mike's input, if he has any.
Great.
So my general question is, you know, if you're sort of mid-career and you have very interesting work, you have a good employer, and everything's going well and it's relatively secure, under what circumstances would you still walk away and find something else?
Let's talk specifically. It's a great question. Tell me about what you're liking and not liking about your current job, and to what extent you are clear or unclear about what you would do if you left.
What I like about it is the work is very interesting, intellectually stimulating. I think it goes to a good cause as well. You know, it's a moral and ethical kind of area of our economy, I think. And all that is great. The work is interesting. Most of the colleagues are great. You know, sort of mid-career, I have this aching feeling that if I just stay, then maybe I'm there too long to make a real change to something at a higher level.
Higher level or different? In order for me to help you, I need your specifics. Don't, you know, you're not admitting to, you know, raping children here. Tell us, what do you do?
Oh, working for the IRS.
Yeah, so I'm a healthcare attorney. I work in the healthcare industry.
No wonder you're careful. Typical lawyer, you know, like, you know, you've got all this disclosed. Everything here is confidential. Okay, so you're a healthcare attorney, and who do you work with? What kind of work do you do? Who do you do?
Yeah, I work for a large healthcare system.
Okay, so you're a Kaiser or whatever. Yeah. Okay, great. And so, and what's, other than this general feeling like you don't, what's making you feel like, oh, I could always, there's so much to grow here. The Affordable Care Act is going to create all kinds of new options and interesting things, and I'm learning ever more. What's keeping you from saying I'm just going to grow in this profession? What's making you, you know, leave this lucrative, prestigious, ethical, and ever-growing field? What's really at the core of your desire to think about leaving?
Well, it's not so much about leaving the industry,
okay,
but about leaving the organization potentially.
Right. So is it because it's so slow and bureaucratic?
No, it's not. It's more like I'm it's a large organization. I'm in middle management, and I'm wondering two things. One, is it maybe better to go to a smaller organization and be higher in it? And sort of have a new...
Is it for money or boredom? What's the motivation? You know, I just wrote an article for Psychology Today called Up? the American way is that up is the only way, that you're somehow plateauing, a loser or whatever, if you just stay put. But I am a big believer in the Peter principle, that millions of people do rise to the level of incompetence. So to what extent, you know, what is your real, is your motivation to move up, a desire to learn? Is it to keep up with the Joneses? Is it to get a little more after tax dollars? Which, by the way, you know, as you well know, any additional $50,000 you would make from moving up is going to be taxed at the maximum rate. It's going to not change your lifestyle. What really is at the core of your desire to, quote, move up?
Just the sense that maybe I'm, even though I work hard, that perhaps maybe I'm treading water as opposed to, like, you know, swimming down the lane as fast as I can, which is more, goes more to, I think, that American ethic. I mean, you know, my parents are immigrants, and
mine too.
They totally internalized the American drive, right? I mean,
and so have I. So let's think. Let's start by thinking cosmically.
Yeah.
Would you do more for the world if you busted butt to try to become a rock star in your current job, or became a leader? In other words, let's say you were the lead or the managing attorney and managed, you know, 10 other attorneys, or you became a lobbyist. Lots of attorneys in healthcare become lobbyists for one entity or another. Cosmically, what would do the greatest good for the world?
The latter.
Okay.
Just for having a broader reach.
Okay, great. So let's fantasize the dream job of maximum impact. I'm just picking one here. Let's say I said to you, I'm not sure I believe that I'm on the fence about single payer, but let's say there was physicians for a single payer healthcare system, and you could get a job as a lobbyist for them. Are you happier?
I think I would miss the business. The business side.
What if I said instead that you were a lobbyist for the Association of Healthcare Providers, Kaiser and Blue Cross and Sutter Health, and you were there on Capitol Hill or in Sacramento, and you're lobbying, you're writing legislation, and you're writing briefs, and you're arguing or arguing for it with the legislative staffers. Are you happier?
I might be. I never thought about that. That is an interesting idea.
Which is better, that or becoming the lead attorney, let's just say, for Kaiser Permanente, where you're supervising 8 people and developing strategy and methods and cost control approaches and whatever? Risk reduction paradigms.
They both sound pretty good. I haven't thought about it, the lobbying one at all before.
So what if I said that's your homework? Good. That's your homework.
The third thing I've been thinking about is whether I should leave the legal side and try to get onto the business side.
Yeah, that's certainly a reasonable option. There are very many companies that like a lawyer with a seat at the table. You know, as they plan strategy in our ever more litigious society, it's always legal considerations have a really important role in every decision that gets made. So. Let's think, though, in terms of what will be fun now for the moment before I let you go.
Yeah.
I want you to be impractical for a nanosecond. We've been practical at this point.
Right.
Would you have more fun having a seat at the table on the business side of some healthcare organization as a lobbyist for a healthcare organization or a series of them? Or as a managing attorney, managing a bunch of lawyers for, and again, we're using Kaiser as just the example.
I would probably put them in that order, just the same order you made it, being the business person at the table with a legal background, but on the business side, secondly, the lobbyist, third, being the head lawyer.
Great. So what if I said for now, you know, SQL, avoid overwhelming you. I'm sure you're working a reasonable number of hours, even though you're not swimming, you know, pardon the Mike Hudson pun, swimming as fast as you can, and, you know, like the salmon. But if I said what I want you to do is I want you to do some smart internet research to find one or two or three people who are lawyers, who do have a seat at the table at a healthcare organization, whether it be like a Sutter or whatever, and I said, and try to write them a letter and saying, am I crazy to want to make this move? And if I'm not crazy, what are the baby steps I need to do in order to get from here to there? Do I need an MBA, or do I need to join some organization, or do I need to take this CEB course from the Bar Association? How do you feel about doing that as a homework assignment?
That sounds great.
There you go.
It didn't occur to me, but that's really that's why I placed this call, to get ideas like that.
Exactly. Well, you're an attorney. I should send you like my $550 an hour billable rate. You know, and I'll charge you by in 6 minute increments. How's that?
Yes.
And I'll double bill you for being on the airplane, and I'll charge you, you know, for two clients. Anyway, all right. Thanks a lot for calling. I can't resist a lawyer joke. What can I tell you? Anyway, thanks a lot for calling. Work with Marty Nemko.
All right. Thank you so much.
You take care. We have time for one more call, maybe even two. It depends how fast. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. My fisherman friend and guest, Mike Hudson. What's your question or comment for either of us?
Hi there.
Hi.
I work with someone that on an international project. I met him through work, and we became good friends. Mm-hmm. And he lives internationally as a citizen internationally, but is interested in coming to the States to work in the tech sector. And there are a lot of jobs available that are really a good fit for him.
Yep.
But will you explain to me either A, the Cliff's Notes, or B, resources where I can find information to help him about visas and what the situation is with visas? If companies, when they say we can only do it during a certain time frame, if that is actually the truth, or if they can actually work some magic to get visas if they actually want it. And then secondly, I know this sounds totally crazy, but he is a good friend of mine. What's the whole situation if we got married in order to help him work here?
Outside of my pay grade, not sure I know, but I know for sure the one thing I can say with great confidence is that if you simply Google H-1B, which is the section code for immigrant visas that are particularly used by tech companies, you will find the law. So instead of relying on what a company has to say, you will find out what is the actual rules. Are there months that there are, you know, every year is they reach their quota and they're done for the year, or is that BS? You can find out that, I think, just by Googling H-1B. And I suspect that also you'll find out the rules about, marriage. I've seen a lot of movies where people marry for those purposes. So I think as so often is the case, I know it's boring for listeners, but, you know, Google is a miracle. To think that so much of the world's content is accessible instantly for free, it's remarkable. And so that's why, you know, at the risk of boring my dear listeners, I think Google will be your friend here. Make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay, thanks a lot.
I didn't know if you had any additional deeper insight than...
Alas, I don't. As I said, that particular one's up above my pay grade.
All right. Thanks very much.
All right. We've got 2 minutes. I want to take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. What's your question or comment for Mike Hudson or myself? Hi, it's you. Are you there?
Hey, Marty. Is it me?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, great, great. Hey, so I've been a technology writer, editor for the last 20-plus years. I'm working for a website now that is going to be sold. It just hasn't I'm not going to be able to stay with them, so I have to look at other options.
Right.
And one of the things that I got involved in more recently was we did a lot of conferences. I got a lot of experience developing the programs and things like that, and I really enjoyed it. But I also like the technology writing and publication stuff. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts about, I mean, there's the obvious thing of trying to get a job at another website, but if you had any other thoughts about another direction,
I wouldn't go there. Given this the limited time we have, the conference, it's amazing in this era where so much occurs online and there are virtual conferences, nonetheless, especially in the tech space, there seems to be no diminution in the number of conferences. And what's fun is instead of, you've already written enough documentation and, articles on version 3.0 and how it's amazingly different than 2.6, but, I think you'll have more fun playing the conference space. So given you have some conference experience, I'd be more inclined to identify, whether it's SIGGRAPH or whatever conference or CES, consumer electronics, go and pitch yourself as somebody who can do a lot of the writing, because so much of the writing of both the programs and the solicitations and the marketing and the emails of those conferences are, need a writing guy. So yeah. I think you'd have a lot more fun pitching yourself as a man, not to be the director, but as an assistant manager or whatever in the tech conference space. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It does make sense. And good. You've kind of confirmed what I was thinking instinctually.
Cool. Well, I'm ahead, and especially as I look up the clock, the time is up for the
Perfect.
Show. So, all right. Thanks a lot for the call.
Hey, thanks.
And again, Mike Hudson, thanks so much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko.
Oh, thanks for having me, Marty. It was great.
One more pitch. I swear to you, there's no downside. I go to Trader Joe's and I spend $11.99 a pound for the wild frozen salmon. He probably charges $15 or $20, but you get it fresh. You support a local guy.
It's more than that. It's more than that these days.
How much is it?
unfortunately. Yeah, it's in the $25 per pound.
Well, if you feel like if you want to put your money where your environmental mouth is, then you should definitely go to MikeHudson.com, to HudsonFish.com, and you can find out where you can get his wild-caught, sustainably grown local salmon and support a very good guy. That is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on calls, and I will do a switch sides in the middle debate with my wife, Barbara Nemko, on the question, is employment testing for drug use ever appropriate? Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.